A plea for British values. Today, Labor Day, September 1st. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. British Prime Minister David Cameron unveils new measures to combat extremism.
Adhering to British values is not an option or a choice. It is a duty for all those who live in these islands.
Also today, a Liberian radio station changes format to devote itself to round-the-clock Ebola coverage.
Ebola is real. We try to just get our people to know that this disease is real and is killing.
And Labor Day shoppers celebrate the return of a supermarket chain catering to immigrants.
Well, it was a grassroots effort, you know, right from the bottom up. And, you know, everyone's coming back.
Plus, the secrets of the Vatican's marble floors, all after this news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. When hundreds of would-be jihadists leave a Western nation to fight abroad, a government is bound to do something about it.
Mr. Speaker, we are proud to be an open, free, and tolerant nation. But that tolerance must never be confused with a passive acceptance of cultures living separate lives or people behaving in ways that run completely counter to our values. Adhering to British values is not an option or a choice. It is a duty for all those who live in these islands.
That's British Prime Minister David Cameron. He spoke today in front of the House of Commons about expanding British terrorism prevention and investigation measures, known in shorthand as TPIMS. His address comes as the terror alert in the UK was elevated to severe late last week. For what all this means, we reached our partners at the BBC. Their Home Affairs correspondent, Dominic Casciani, has been on the case.
The British police know that there are hundreds of men who have gone out to fight in Syria. Some of those guys will now be in Iraq as well. They want to try to stop these people going. They want to be able to monitor them on their way home. The toolkit they've got to do that is fairly limited. So, for instance, if the Home Secretary has prior knowledge that someone's travelling to Syria, she can use a special power called the Royal Prerogative, effectively exercising the power in the Queen's name, to seize somebody's passport before they get to the departure gate at an airport. Now, the police can't do that themselves. So these are the kind of powers that the government now says it wants to create. And the most controversial element of this package is a suggestion that the police and the security services could actually also stop people returning, even if they are British citizens.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really curious aspect to these proposals. Wouldn't that, denying passports for those British citizens coming back to the UK, wouldn't that leave some people stateless, possibly?
This is the really big issue. Look, the UK already has a power to render somebody stateless, providing it can prove to a judge that that person has a possible second nationality that they can adopt, like somebody who was born in the UK but has Pakistani parents. We've seen it used in that kind of context. But there's this vague area here that if a passport was cancelled while someone's out of the country, does that leave them stateless? And in fact, this afternoon in the House of Commons, the concern was so much that one of David Cameron's former closest allies told MPs that he did not think this was workable. Now, this was a real shot across the bows of government. It would be the equivalent of the chief counsel in the White House saying to the president, I'm sorry, your proposal isn't going to work and I'm going to tell people publicly that it won't work. So there is a lot at stake here.
What are some people saying about the risks that these new tools could be abused? I mean, is there concern?
There is some concern from within Muslim communities, but there's also concern on a broader sense of how are we dealing with the Syria problem? If you think that 500-odd people have probably gone from the UK to fight in Syria, some of the people have returned and have become, in the eyes of police, a terror threat. They've already been arrested and there are trials pending before the courts. Now, one of the arguments is that if you create more and more tools which securitize the Syria problem, you will have a situation where people who went off to fight against the Assad regime in Syria will suddenly start regarding the UK as part of the problem when, in fact, all they went to do was to fight against the Assad regime and not necessarily against the UK. Now, this is a real concern because some of the people who say these tools aren't needed are suggesting that what the government should be doing is spending more time, money and effort trying to de-radicalise these people who are coming back brutalised from a foreign war so they can be reintegrated into society.
Was it the beheading of journalist James Foley and the apparent British accent of his killer? Did that start all of this?
I think that's been a key issue in bringing this very firmly to the public eye. I think the concerns have been building for many months. Some cynics say that the government's moves over the past week has been as a result of James Foley, that it had to be seen to be doing something. But my understanding is a lot of these debates have been very subtle in the background, with the police going back to ministers and saying, look, we're seeing these people leaving the country. We need more powers to try and stop them.
Our friend Dominic Casciani, the Home Affairs correspondent for the BBC, joining us from London. Thank you.
Thank you.
It isn't just Britain, of course, concerned about the rise of global terrorism. Earlier today, the UN held an emergency debate to discuss the crisis in Iraq. Officials learned of, quote, acts of inhumanity on an unimaginable scale, allegedly perpetrated by fighters from the militant group ISIS. Jan Egeland used to lead the humanitarian relief efforts for the UN, and he's currently in northern Iraq, where he's touring and assessing refugee camps there.
Every 5 minutes you hear stories from families who tell about witnessing massacres, witnessing neighbors, families, relatives being massacred. They all tell about stories about also young girls and others being abducted. Some of these may end up in human trafficking to Europe, perhaps North America. So the ultimate irony is that Europe and North America, which is not very welcoming to receive refugees, may end up having trafficked people from these regions. It is this which is the Syrian catastrophe and the Iraqi one, which are now one big war and exodus, is the biggest challenge on our watch, on this generation's watch. And no, we're not meeting up to the challenge at all.
You know, your notion that this is the biggest and most consequential humanitarian crisis of our time, I mean, connect the dots for us. Tell us why this is the biggest.
Because it has engulfed so many million of people in a war without any laws, any norms, at all. You know, I've been a in and out of humanitarian work and peace work and human rights work since I was 19, which is nearly 40 years ago. In the 1990s, we had a comparable situation because that was the age of the genocides. So more people were killed in the Balkans and in Rwanda at that time than are being killed now. But they were not even close to affecting so many people that were then driven away, forced to flee, lost livelihoods, lost hope. That's what's so tremendous here. 10 million people minimum have become refugees or displaced in or from Syria. And we have another 2-3 million in Iraq with the new and the old refugees and displaced. It's beyond belief, really. And that comes on top of all of the things that are happening elsewhere in the world, from Gaza to South Sudan to Central African Republic to Somalia to Afghanistan and whatnot.
So has the West adequately addressed this humanitarian crisis?
I don't think the West has at all addressed it adequately. And I would question, has the Arab world done that? What about the ASEANs? What about Russia? What about China? What about ASEAN countries? There are so many who could have done much, much more. The powers involved, and that includes Saudis, Iranians, Americans, the Turks, many others, will have to sit down and say, can we please now stop undermining each other and let's pull it together? I mean, it sounds totally naive, but that's what has to be done. There is a lot of proxy war here. Some nations are willing to fight each other to the last Syrian, really.
Just today, news came that Iraqi forces took the northern town of Amerli from ISIS fighters. Do you think that that's a sign the tide may be shifting in northern Iraq?
Well, it could be that some advances will now have stopped and some sieges can be lifted. What's not over is, I think, displacement and conflict. The front lines may now change. They may fall back. but there will be more war and there will be more killing, and it's the civilians who are paying the price.
Jan Egeland is the former United Nations Relief Coordinator. He now heads a Norwegian Refugee Council. He joined us from Erbil in northern Iraq. Mr. Egeland, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Ask Arabs in northern Iraq about displacement, and some will tell you that ISIS is not the problem. It's the Kurds. Once upon a time, Arabs and Kurds lived together in mixed villages, more or less integrated. But now some Arabs say Kurds are kicking them out under the guise of eliminating ISIS. Rebecca Collard reports from Erbil.
At a junction between Erbil and Makmur, Garib Nahid Ojel waits with his family. His daughter-in-law is breastfeeding an infant, sitting on the sandy ground in the 40-plus degree heat. The baby is crying. We are coming back because the Kurdish people we work with need our help with the farming, says Garib, who is originally from Tel Abda, between Mosul and Makmur. They asked us to go back because we always work together. A small truck pulls up, and an officer from the SIS, the Kurdish intelligence, gets out, flanked by Peshmerga fighters. Tell them Arabs are not allowed to enter these provinces, the officer says, pointing at Garib's family. All the Arabs are with ISIS. No, no, I promise I'm not, protests Garib. But the Kurdish officer is unmoved. Garib's wife begins pleading. We are not fighters. We are not combatants. We are just families, she says. We just want to find a safe place. In the village of Makmur, men are quick to accuse their Arab neighbors of cooperating with ISIS. These Arabs supported Saddam Hussein and his Ba'ath party also, this man says. They are remnants of the old regime. They never liked us Kurds, so now they're helping ISIS to push Kurds out of this area. Arabs and Kurds have always shared the villages of Makmur. But under what was called Saddam Hussein's Arabization policy, many Arab families were moved in to displace Kurds. The idea was to break the Kurdish hold on the region and lay claim to the fertile farmlands. But when Saddam Hussein fell in 2003, waves of Kurds began moving back, and they weren't always nice about it. Some Arabs were paid to leave, others were pushed out. Fahmi Sabir is a 41-year-old Kurd. He says when he moved to Makmur, he and his Arab neighbor Mohammed became friends. When ISIS advanced on the city, everyone fled Makmur. But since it was retaken by Kurdish forces, Arabs like Mohammed haven't been allowed back to their homes. Fahmi calls Mohammed on the phone.
Shouak ali Mohammed.
Where are you, asked Fahmi. Mohammed says he and his family are in Kirkuk. We hear some Arab homes were burnt down in Makmur, says Mohammed. I just checked your house. Everything is fine, and your brother's house too, Fahmi assures him. Only a few, not yours, he says, just those that were involved with ISIS. In his home, in a predominantly Arab neighborhood of Makmur, Kurdish resident Sorhan Sabri shows me a video of what he says are two dead ISIS fighters. He says one of the young Arab men lying on the ground surrounded by Kurdish fighters is Saleh, and that he was a good customer and friend for years. Soren says his friend was the only local Arab he knows who decided to fight with the Sunni extremists. But most Kurds here believe there are many more, and feel they've been stabbed in the back by their Arab neighbors. I was very happy to see him dead, says Soren. It doesn't make any sense that Saleh would join jihadis against his own neighbors. It's impossible to know how many Arab residents of this region actually joined up with ISIS. But while authorities claim that Arabs not involved with ISIS will be allowed to return home, many worry the Kurds are doing what Saddam Hussein did, but in reverse, using the fight against ISIS as an excuse to change demographics here once again and stake their claim to the area. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard, Erbil, northern Iraq.
Still ahead, a radio station changes format for a disease and doesn't lose listeners. On The World from PRI. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. What better story for Labor Day than one about a labor action that happened right here in our own backyard? Over a month ago, the family-run Market Basket grocery chain fired its longtime CEO, Arthur T. Demoulas. The employees, a group seriously loyal to Arthur T., responded by leading a company-wide protest. They picketed and encouraged shoppers to go somewhere else. And guess what? They won. Arthur T. Demoulas is back. The news made Michael Dunleavy a happy man. He runs the Market Basket in Somerville, Massachusetts. Michael says the store today is busy getting back on its feet.
The produce department is completely full. We have every item on the counters now. As far as customers, it's bustling in here right now.
And this is Labor Day. It's a vacation day for most people.
Right.
For you at the office, as it were, how does it feel to be back?
Well, it's great to be back. Labor Day itself, Monday Labor Day, is actually traditionally a pretty busy day in the supermarkets. It's the last day of everyone's summer vacation before school starts. So we were hoping for a busy day, and it's happening.
You know, Michael, one of the reasons our program, The World, is interested in this saga is because Market Basket has a loyal bunch of shoppers, and many of them are immigrants on low incomes, but they can find the things at your store that they could purchase back, even in rural areas, back in their home countries. How much do you think these shoppers, these immigrant shoppers, were part of the success of your campaign to get CEO Arthur Demoulas back?
Well, it was a grassroots effort, you know, right from the bottom up. And this part of Somerville, well, the whole city of Somerville, is like a boiling pot of all kind of immigrant families. And we try to cater to as many as we can, if not all. And, you know, we've made phone calls and got the same products we always were able to get, and hopefully that brings them all back.
Yeah, I mean, do you think the company will be able to continue keeping that familiar inventory for those immigrant shoppers and keeping prices low?
Yes, I really believe so.
Your store took a pretty big hit, though. I mean, the labor action lasted a good month. At one point, you had told us that weekly sales were down 90%, 90%. How long will it take for you guys to rebound?
I think by the end of this week, we should be back to almost 100%.
Wow, that's fast.
Yeah, everybody's jumped in feet first.
Do you think the whole 4 weeks, this labor action, do you think it was all worth it?
Oh, it definitely was. This is much better than what what could have happened, and that would have been deadly.
Yeah, and so what could have happened? What was the worst-case scenario?
Worst-case scenario, they closed doors or sold to another company, and anything like that, it just wouldn't have been the same. The benefits would have been changed. Pay structures would have been changed. You know, everything that we've always worked for and been treated well by Arthur T. Demoulas probably would have went down the drain.
Yeah, it was a pretty dramatic labor action. It even made international headlines in the pages of the Guardian newspaper in the UK. Why do you think it had this resonance around the globe?
Well, it's probably something that's never really happened before. Usually it's companies trying to get rid of their CEO, and I think we're one of the first companies ever to try to bring our CEO back. It's unprecedented.
So what do you think are the big lessons for people around the globe from the Market Basket saga?
Well, I think if you're treated well by your CEO and it's someone you want to keep to run your company and it's running great, by all means, fight for them. If somehow or another the board of directors or however the structure of the company is set up tries to eliminate them, stand straight up and raise your hand and fight for what you think's right.
So on this Labor Day, Michael Dunleavy, what are your hours?
Today we're open normal hours, 7 a.m. to 9 p.m.
What time do you get to go home?
Myself, when the job's done. Usually around 5 o'clock, but if it takes a little longer today, we will.
Michael Dunleavy, the store manager at the Market Basket in Somerville, Massachusetts. Great to speak with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Here's someone who followed the rule of sticking around till the job is done. Michelangelo. You don't think that in the middle of painting a fresco at the Sistine Chapel, he just clocked off every day at 5, do you? If you've ever been to the Vatican, you know the feeling of walking around with your neck bent toward the ceiling. But as Jake Warga tells us, there's also a lot to see beneath your feet.
I'm at the Vatican with Dr. Christopher Longhurst. He's the
Operatore Didactico, teaching operator in the Vatican Museums.
Our first stop is the Basilica of St. Peter's. When you enter, it's hard not to look up. The whole design directs your gaze to the ceilings, at basically the promise of heaven. However, I made it only as far as the portico, the entrance door, before tripping on the unevenly worn floor and asked Chris about it.
This is rose porphyry, a stone that's reserved only to the imperial family. It's extinct today. It can't be quarried today. So you can guarantee this is being recycled from an imperial space.
It's some really tough marble, unlike the softer marble worn around it through centuries of visitors.
Using a laser, for example, it would take about an hour to cut an inch into porphyry.
Once inside the basilica, we stop directly on a circle of the same red stone.
This is the precise place where Charlemagne was crowned Holy Roman Emperor on Christmas Day 800, on this very porphyry disc, which would have been in the sanctuary of the old St. Peter's.
And that's something the versatile popes did a lot of, scavenging and repurposing a material. Why pay for new works when you can pilfer it?
Most of this marble that you're looking at is not being quarried for this church. It's being recycled from the Roman Forum, from the Colosseum. The reason why the Colosseum is in the state it's in today is not because of the passing of time. No, it's because the popes used those places as quarries.
So why go through all the effort of making or even relocating a floor that's just for walking on?
Ad maiorem Dei gloriam, all for the greater glory of God. That was the motto. If you can do it more magnificently, more splendidly, then so be it.
We exit into St. Peter's Square, paved with little cobblestones called San Petrini, which Chris fondly calls Little St. Peter Stones. There's a plaque on the ground marking where, in 1981, an assassination attempt was made on John Paul II. Chris sets the scene.
So the Pope was exiting in his Pope Mobile.
Anytime someone says that.
I'm sorry, Pope Mobile to me is one of the funniest words in the world.
It's called the Pope Mobile. It's designed especially for him to travel.
Right, back to our story.
Precisely at this place, when someone standing around here took out a gun and shot at the Pope. So here you have his coat of arms. The M beneath the cross represents Mary at the foot of the cross, because he believes that it was thanks to the Virgin Mary, a lady of Fatima, who saves his life.
We left when we could no longer see the ground. There were so many tourists. Busloads were queuing up to see the inside. It seemed like everyone was photographing the buildings or themselves in front of the buildings, but few were looking down at the past, except to avoid tripping in the present. From the Vatican, I'm Jake Warga.
Labor Day is not the official end of summer, but for most of us, sadly, it's about as official as it gets. Our old friend and blogger Adeline Sia spent most of her summer in her native France, visiting family and swimming. At PRI.org, you can find her thoughts on rules at those swimming pools. I was on Cape Cod this summer. You've got to follow regulations at the fragile little ponds there. But compared to the French, the Cape Cod regs seem almost limp. A few years ago, I was at the swimming pool Adeline writes about. And let's just say my American baggy trunks did not cut it in France. I was instructed to purchase a Speedo at the pool's vending machine. No joke. Adeline Sear picks up the theme of onerous rules at swimming pools at PRI.org, of course. News headlines are next here on The World from PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Just ahead, in Pakistan's capital, protesters with clubs storm the state broadcaster. It all happened on live TV.
This just in, as we said earlier, protesters have managed to barge their way into PTV headquarters, and they've even made their way into some of the newsrooms, and they're armed with sticks and batons. And the important thing is that we remain calm right now.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Imagine you're watching your local television news, getting your dose of the weather or sports, when suddenly this announcement comes on.
Well, this just in, as we said earlier, protesters have managed to barge their way into PTV headquarters, and they've even made their way into some of the newsrooms, and they're armed with sticks and batons. And the important thing is that we remain calm right now. There's no reason to panic at this stage, and we'll update you with more news as it comes in.
That's what Pakistanis heard today from their national broadcaster, PTV, just before the station went off the air in the capital, Islamabad. Protesters had forced their way into the studio, wielding sticks, and smashed the place up. This incident was the culmination of increasingly violent protests against Pakistan's Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif. Hundreds of people have been injured, several even died. The BBC's Shazeb Jilani is in Islamabad and has been at the protests. What happened at the TV station today, Shazeb?
it was all very surreal. I mean, the last time I remember watching these kind of images was in 1999 when there was a military coup and soldiers took over state broadcaster. But what happened today was these angry young men who basically barged into the building. They were met with very little resistance. They went inside into newsrooms, into studios. They smashed equipment. They harassed staff. They cut cable wires. And we were watching this on live TV, and the channel went off air. But it only took about less than an hour for the army troops to arrive. They started clearing the building. They asked the protesters to leave. The protesters, however angry they were, they obliged. They were actually cheering for the army, and they were shouting slogans in favor of the army. So they're angry with the government, with Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, but they're absolutely supportive of the army.
So what is driving these protests? Or maybe we should ask, who is driving these protests?
That's a good question. On the face of it, there are two opposition figures. One is a cleric, Dr. Tahir al-Qadri. He's been based in Canada for a very long time. He returned to Pakistan a couple of months ago and started his anti-government campaign. He wants a revolution in Pakistan. Imran Khan is Pakistan's former cricket captain, a charismatic personality. He's been in politics. He has seats in the parliament. He has the second biggest opposition party in Pakistan's parliament. He alleges electoral fraud in last year's national election, and he says he didn't get justice, and he's now forced to take it to the streets. This is how it all started. But right now, there's a single point agenda for both these men, and they want the prime minister to resign.
All right. So it sounds like there's a political element to this. You've been at the front line of these disturbances in the streets, as you say. Who are the protesters and what do they want? What do they hope to achieve?
Well, as I said, they're followers of Dr. Qadri and Imran Khan. They've come here prepared for confrontation. They're wielding sticks. They've come with gas masks, throwing stones at police. They were provoking police while we were there. And day before yesterday, the police retaliated. And as a result, we had about 400 people who were injured and at least three people died. The protesters are now gaining more and more ground. They're spreading. They're occupying more and more space. The police is not retaliating. And the protesters are going on a rampage. They're having a field day in Islamabad.
You know, we often hear how in a military coup, the national broadcaster is one of the first targets by the coup makers. How rare is it that citizens will go into the TV station and ransack the place? Or does that suggest that maybe there is some support from other parties, maybe even the military?
There's deep suspicion in Pakistan that these events aren't organic, that there are elements in the army who are encouraging these protests. And there's a track record. For example, Pakistan's main intelligence agency, the ISI, has a bad reputation when it comes to Afghanistan, India, and Kashmir, and so on. But within the country, ISI is disliked because of its tendency to engineer crisis when none existed, to manipulate things, to undermine civilian governments, to make them want to become weak and not challenge the military on broader strategic policy matters. So that belief is very much there. Pakistan being Pakistan, you will be hard-pressed to find a person who will say the army has no role in whatever is happening here.
I mean, the planet has an interest in a stable Pakistan, given it's a nuclear state. Are we to believe that this is kind of an overture to a military coup?
Well, that's what people fear, that if this crisis doesn't get resolved peacefully and politically, there may be no other option. There is no other institution which has the power and the capacity to then step in and say, well, enough is enough, and we need to put things back in order. That's what the military has done in the past. I mean, throughout the decades of the 90s, the Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, they brought down each other's governments every couple of years. And that's why 90s are referred to as the lost decade for Pakistan, because economically it suffered, politically it suffered, and the country just could not agree on what to do.
The BBC's Shahzeb Jilani in Islamabad, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
This is nothing new for Pakistan or the region, these kind of heated protests. Think back 3 years ago to the Arab Spring. It was social media that got a lot of credit for fueling those revolutions. In Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, and Libya, young people flooded sites like Twitter and Facebook with videos captured on their smartphones, then watched as their streets filled with protesters called to action. In Libya, nothing settled down after the revolution. Fighting there continues, but the smartphones are still playing a role, not in revolt, but in healing and dealing with the emotional fallout from their failed uprising. 9 Libyan activists and former combatants recently got some training for that. Anne Bailey is a photojournalist and multimedia professor who was asked to participate in the training. So she went to Rome, and here's her story of what she found.
Tariq Arate takes his time finding the right words. He's playing the part of victim in a mock interview designed to teach him and 8 fellow Libyans how to conduct healing testimonies with survivors of sexual violence and torture in Libya after the 2011 revolution. When he finally speaks, his voice is low.
Well, the feeling is I'm very, very sad. All over the country, things are not satisfactory at all. We were very happy about the revolution in its beginnings, but now things are not as we hoped for. There are about 70,000 people displaced.
It turns out this isn't just role play for Tariq. In August 2011, an anti-Qaddafi militia drove out all 30,000 residents of Tuerga, his hometown in northern Libya near Misrata. The revolutionary fighters claimed the city's residents supported Qaddafi in the battle for Libya. For Tariq, the psychological trauma of it all was devastating.
What happened, the way that I was forced to leave my own city, like, affected me so bad. Because I was forced to leave by my own cousins, my own people, it was even more and more suffering for me.
So that's the first rule. Second one, tripod. Use it as much as you can.
I've been invited to Rome by the Arapaces Initiative, a peace and reconciliation NGO based in Italy. I'm not a counselor or an activist. My job is to teach these Libyans how to use smartphones to record and edit high-quality videos. I've led similar workshops in Congo and Tunisia, but this one is different. It isn't a journalistic exercise. Here, the lofty goal is to help heal and reconcile real trauma in Libya, a country where victims of torture, and rape especially, are expected to suffer in silence.
Take your camera, your tripod, and you have to film a sequence.
We work on the basics of smartphone video and editing for 3 days. Violence against journalists is high in Libya, so Arapaces decided smartphones would be safer for students and less intimidating for victims already fearful of speaking out. There are also classes with experts in international conflict resolution, human rights, and oral history.
So 11:15, come back here.
Tariq now lives in Tripoli, where he visits other displaced Tuaregans in 5 refugee camps scattered throughout the city. Like Tariq, if they returned home, the militia that still guards what is now a ghost town would likely kill them. When I visit the camps, everything feels so gloomy, Tariq tells me. Even 5- and 6-year-olds are depressed, and the only thing on their mind is revenge. It's controlling their lives.
And when I'm talking to the old people, I'm just trying to give them hope or feeling, but I just feel like I want to cry.
The idea that these men and women can help heal their country by producing video testimonies seems idealistic. Libya is a country where speaking publicly about personal issues flies in the face of social norms. It's clear to me that some of these students are here as journalists and activists, not healers. They will likely make a difference back in Libya, but whether they'll heal anything or anyone isn't clear. The night before I go, I ask Tariq if he thinks he's healed from his own trauma. He tells me yes, that he's gotten over being driven from Tuerga and moved on, and that's how it's supposed to be. But then he backtracks a bit. Look, I'm displaced, he says. I have a lost identity. Really, the question is very difficult to answer. For The World, I'm Ann Bailey, Rome.
Tomorrow in The World, life in Libya remains precarious, a situation, as this regional analyst says, perhaps like no other in history.
We see two parallel governments, two parallel authorities, completely independent of each other and completely ignorant of each other. And there are no geographical boundaries. And people who support each of those authorities are mixed in geographically with the other.
Marine Olivezi has our story tomorrow from Tripoli. Life remains precarious as well in West Africa, especially for those infected by the Ebola virus. Photographer Pete Muller was recently on assignment for the Washington Post in Sierra Leone. He was reporting on the Ebola outbreak. He says he returned to his base in Nairobi from Sierra Leone with some powerful impressions.
Well, I think certainly what struck me the most was the extent of the epidemic and, you know, a number of the humanitarian actors, namely Doctors Without Borders, truly stretched to their capacity.
As a photojournalist, what does that mean visually? Where was your eye drawn?
One thing that I found to be particularly interesting was, so one way of curtailing the spread of Ebola, transmission is particularly acute when people are dealing with the bodies of those who've died of Ebola. And what's happened is that the International Federation of the Red Cross has stepped in an attempt to curtail these traditional burials. But they have, for the entire district of Kailaun, which is really the epicenter of the outbreak, they had about 20 workers who are dealing with the bodies. They had 2 to 3 vehicles, and they were tasked with, you know, safely burying all the people who are passing away in the entire district of Kailaun. So you saw a group of people who are absolutely overstretched in terms of trying to stem this very critical part of the epidemic.
I mean, your pictures, which we'll have a selection of at PRI.org, I mean, they really kind of hammer home just what a surreal scene it must be. I mean, I lived for several years in West Africa in rural parts, and to think of men dressed in what amounts to spacesuits coming into these mud brick homes, and it must be really scary for these people to see their loved ones being taken away by these strange people.
For sure, people are, you know, in a very remote village where people have limited exposure to the outside world, to see people come in that type of attire is extremely disheartening. I saw at least the civilian population that is terrified of Ebola has really come to terms with the fact that the virus is very real and that it's had a devastating effect on many communities. And people are being cooperative. In Sierra Leone, the entire population is upholding a policy of no touching. So throughout the country, no one is shaking hands. Even in crowds, you hear people telling each other not to touch one another. And as awful and devastating as it is to not be able to engage in the traditional burial practices, people understand that this virus is very real and they want to abide by what the officials are telling them.
From your photographs, Pete, it looks like you were using in many shots a wide-angle lens, which tends to distort, and your images imply that you were standing closer than that 6 feet kind of recommended as a cutoff point. But what about you? Were you concerned?
I was very concerned. I was extremely vigilant in terms of what I perceived to be high-risk exposure. You're right, Marco, that they do recommend a 2-meter or about 6-foot buffer zone between you and anything that's considered to be high risk. And I tried as best I could to abide by that and certainly never came into any direct contact with any bodies or infected people. But, you know, also I think it's important to keep in mind that the transmission of Ebola, while it is highly contagious among people who are infected and symptomatic, people don't get it off of door handles and money. You know, it comes from contact with the bodily fluids of people who are infected and symptomatic. So while I was extraordinarily vigilant, almost to a neurotic degree, I also tried to balance that in my own mind with some medical information about how the virus is actually transmitted.
You must have seen a really stressful side of life for Sierra Leonean families. For you as a photographer, Pete, what was the most hopeful image you came away with from Sierra Leone?
Well, I think something that certainly experts informed me of is that, you know, we're seeing higher rates of survival in this outbreak than we'd seen in any previous outbreak. So I was fortunate on a couple of days to accompany Doctors Without Borders health promotion officials as they brought survivors of the virus back to their home environments. So, you know, we're seeing 30 to 50% in terms of survival rates as opposed to preceding epidemics, which were upwards of 90% fatality from Ebola. So while the crisis is certainly acute and people are terrified and the ramifications are severe, there is the positive element that more people are surviving this particular strain of the disease than they have in previous outbreaks.
And those survivors who come back home, how are they treated?
people still have a high degree of fear about people who've returned. They can face pretty severe stigmatization, which of course compounds what they've already experienced, being inside a facility, seeing a tremendous amount of sickness and death, grappling with their own survival. So it's a complex experience for people who come away from this, who are fortunate enough to survive.
Photographer Pete Muller, recently on assignment for the Washington Post in Sierra Leone. Again, we'll have some of his powerful photos from his trip at PRI.org. Pete, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
You're tuned to The World on PRI, Public Radio International, and on PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. And now a word from Hot FM in Monrovia, Liberia.
People, the government strain segment in turn, they call it Ebola. Let's keep our eyes open for any signs of Ebola. Ebola is real. Protect yourself, your family, and your community. Don't wait to experience it before you believe it. It's real. This message is from the Ministry of Health and Social Welfare and partners.
That's the kind of public service announcement you hear a lot these days in Liberia, and not just on news stations or as a quick drop-in during hit music programs. One station in Monrovia went even further, the dreaded format change. Now Hot FM is all Ebola music and messages all the time. DJ Blue is a station manager at Hot FM and its evening DJ. I mean, in the U.S., DJ Blue, if a station goes through this kind of format change, it's a huge deal. Why'd you decide to go all Ebola all the time?
Well, it's our responsibility that being one of the most listened stations among the youth and young adults, we took it as our responsibility to lead the fight in disseminating the information out to our people.
And what exactly is the message that Hot FM is trying to get across to Liberia?
Ebola is real. Unfortunately, the illiteracy rate in our country is up there. So we try to just get our people to know that this disease is real and is killing.
I mean, we've been hearing that some people still don't believe Ebola is real. Is the message getting out?
Yes, it is getting out, but unfortunately, very slowly. You have people that have this tight root in their tradition, especially people out there in the interior. They're so loyal to that tradition. They're breaking it. It's such a challenge.
And we've also been hearing not just about your station, but Ebola-themed music, young composers coming up with hip-hop and raps about Ebola. Are those messages in music? Is that working as well?
It's working. You know, it is working. You know, people are watching their hands. People are not going in crowded areas. I think it's working. It's not working as fast as it should, but it is working.
Now, it seems like a natural Ebola-themed music for your station, Hot FM, since it's a music station. But why do you think a music station is the way to reach people? Why wouldn't a news and information station kind of take on the 24/7 Ebola message?
Let me tell you, even with all the thing about Ebola going around, people still want to relax. People still want to listen to music. But we use those times to put in drops. Even during the time of music, even during the time of so-called partying time on the station, we still get that message across. All our programs right now have some message of this awareness embedded into it. Some message of Ebola embedded into it.
Yeah, and no matter what happens in the news here in the States, when people tune to their regular station and they hear something that they're not used to, they complain quite often. Have you heard complaints from people who are not happy with the format change?
Well, some complaints. You know, I was on because I usually do a show from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. daily. There was a caller calling and said, "Look, man, in the Liberian slang, my man, we tire you about this whole Ebola business, man. Play us some music or do something else, you know." But more people are glued to the radio to hear information about Ebola, about doctors coming into the city, about new quarantine centers, about new cases, about which area is being more affected. And those are things we do. Those are information we gave out.
DJ Blue, just quickly, what's been the most popular of these Ebola-themed songs?
Well, this one is called Ebola is Real. This is by local artist F.A., the local group Soul Fresh, and another local artist, Dench. Let me tell you something about this song. It has gotten so popular in Liberia till a 3-year-old girl can sing that song because We produce it, at Hot FM, but it's played on every last media outlet throughout the country. You know, it goes something like, Ebola is real. You better protect your family. Ebola is real.
Thank you, DJ Blue. Great to speak with you.
Thanks.
Hot FM. In every household in Monrovia, that's why we are absolutely number one.
It's real. It's time to protect yourself. Ebola is here. Protect your family. Ebola is here. Protect your community. Ebola
is here. Even though parts of West Africa are staggering under the weight of the disease, not all musicians there have refocused on Ebola. This, for example, is from a compilation I've been playing a lot for the past few months. This is Homegrown Soul, Folk and Blues from Guinea. You're hearing one of the artists featured on the CD, the single-named musician Sisoko, and his tune Dali. Collection, it's a mouthful, so don't try writing it down while you're driving. Just FYI, it's called Sembe Mafafe, Roots Volume. It's presented by Stronghold Sound, a studio and record label based in San Francisco. Stronghold gained a niche reputation for releasing hip-hop from the Middle East. For the Sembe Mafafe CD, producer Dub Snacker went to Guinea to discover new sounds there, but in the process, Dub Snacker was equally smitten with some established and elder Guinean artists, as well as the new generation of musicians just waiting to burst. This is really a killer collection. Here's a track from some of the younger upstarts, the brother and sister duo Saran. That is Saran Diabate and her brother Lansini on bass. We'll leave you with their track, Toucan, from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. For those of you on holiday, and for those of you who did work today, happy Labor Day.
Co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported in part by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include the Tagney Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. By the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the Ford Foundation, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.